Wealth Management Redefined.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. We're going to be talking about Iran with Professor Nader Hashimi. And later on, I'm going to be opening the phone lines to get your feel on the Send Her Home and all that that we have been listening to in the past few days. Listen to this lovely music by a young Iranian. His name is Mohsen Yaghna, and he is singing a song in Persian, and it's called I Promise You. Stay tuned. This is WMNF Tampa.
خاطرشی اما دلت میسوزه تصور میکنی عاشقمی این بازی هر روز نترس آدم دمه رفتن همش دلشوره میگیره دو روز بگذره این دلشوره ها از بهت قول میدم سخت نیست لاغل برای تو راحت باش دورم از تو و دنیای تو جای تو دلشوره دارم من بهت قول میدم سخت نیست لاغل برای تو راحت باش دورم از تو و دنیای تو راحت باش هیچ کس نمیاد جای تو دلشوره چیزی که میشناسم و از من گرفتی تو باقی مونده احساسم و از من گرفتی و میخوای من باشی و یادت بره مایی وجود داره خودت آماده رفتنی و ترست نمیذاره اصلا نترس راحت برو بی من هیچگی به جز تو منو یادش نیست فکر کردی کی از من خبر داره راحت برو هیچگی حواسش نیست به تو
دیدم سخت نیست
راحت باش دورم از تو و دنیای تو راحت باش هیچ کس نمیاد جای تو دلشوره دارم من
Welcome back to True Talk. I'm pleased to say that I have with me Professor Nader Hashimi. He is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies, I think at the University of Denver. Good morning, Professor Nader.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. I have no idea, of course, what the song is saying, so I hope it's pleasant things. I think it's a love song in Persian.
Correct.
Professor Nader is originally Canadian, and he is also originally from Iran. He has written many interesting books, but we're not going to be talking about his books today. We're going to be talking about several articles that he has written. The last one that caught my attention was titled Donald Trump and the Strangling of Persia. It's a lot to deal with, Professor Nader, but how about we start with the title, Donald Trump and the Strangling of Persia. What do you mean by that?
Well, the title of the article was a response to current tensions between the United States and Iran, and I was trying to provide a historical perspective on this current moment of crisis. And the actual title, The Strangling of Persia, is the title of a very important book that was published roughly 100 years ago by an American lawyer and civil servant, Morgan Schuster, who traveled to Iran to support the Iranian Democratic Forces, who were victorious in Iran's very famous and important constitutional revolution. And he was there to try and reorganize and modernize Iran's finances that were in a state of deep disarray because of the corrupt rule of the monarchy. And Morgan Schuster's presence there in support of Iranian democratic forces was strongly protested and objected to by the great powers at that time that were trying to subjugate and control Iran, Great Britain and Russia. And so I use that title and I tell that story as a way of drawing the reader's attention to the fact that Iran has a very long and sordid history of facing external intervention, aggression, subjugation from the great powers. And what we're seeing today at this current moment under Donald Trump has to be understood against that historical background. Now, having said that, this is no way an attempt to try and justify or excuse the really horrendous policies of the Islamic Republic, both domestically and regionally, but it is meant to make the point that Iranians today within Iran that are really the primary victims of these policies coming from outside are understanding and viewing Donald Trump's more aggressive policy toward the Islamic Republic through this historic lens. And I also wanted to make the point that, you know, this belief that Iranian that war hawks in Washington, John Bolton, Pompeo, et cetera, have that if they, you know, they naively believe that if you simply squeeze Iran, the people there are going to rise up and welcome some sort of external support for regime change. That's a complete fantasy because it smacks against a series of very important events that have shaped modern Iranian history and political culture.
Some people may think that our relationship, the U.S. relationship with Iran, started maybe after the 1979 Iranian Revolution and then the hostage crisis, and then later on with our dual support, I think, of the Iraq invasion of Iran and never allowing either side to be victorious. But you talk about a little bit, maybe briefly, but maybe let's refresh our listeners' memory about the 1953 coup. Can you address that before we get into the Iranian Revolution?
Sure. After World War II, the United States emerges in the Middle East as the new dominant external power that is influencing the politics of the region, supplanting and surpassing Great Britain, that was the dominant power at the time. And so there's a very important series of events that happens in the early 1950s that really shapes Iran's political development and significantly undermines Iran's potential to democratize when in 1953 the United States, in alliance with Britain, stage a military coup d'etat that subverts and topples the democratically elected prime minister at the time, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was trying to nationalize Iran's oil industry, which was then under the control of British Petroleum. And what happens, to make a long story short, is that Mohammad Mossadegh is toppled via this CIA coup. The weak and corrupt monarch at the time who had fled the country, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah of Iran, is brought back to the country and installed in power. And the United States and the West effectively backed the Shah from 1953 right up until 1979. And they supported all of his authoritarian and draconian policies that really set the stage for the 1979 revolution. So that particular event, I think, is absolutely essential if one wants to understand how we have arrived at this current moment of crisis between the United States and Iran. You cannot understand current tensions between the United States and Iran by going back to the 79 revolution. You really have to go back to 1953 when the events that I just described, I think, brought us to the 1979 revolution, and then subsequent to 1979, I think most of your listeners know the rest of the story. So that's a very important, I think, event of external intervention and subversion that really, I think, I would argue, and I have argued, undermined Iran's best potential to democratize in its modern history. Had that intervention not taken place, the likelihood of a transition to democracy in Iran would have been very high. And I would argue that perhaps the entire Middle East and the Islamic world would look very different.
That's exactly my second thought and comment here, Professor Hashimi, that this 1953 coup and supporting dictators has reflected on the rest of the Arab world, where people tell us, like me here, of Arab and Palestinian origin in America, that we somehow are not we cannot accept democratization and election and all that, without ever paying attention to the role of the U.S. in particular in propping up dictator systems in that part of the world. So I think 1953 is not reflective of Iran only, but of the rest of the Arab world. Would you agree that if this had not happened, and this intervention, not only in Iran, but in the regional countries, democratization would have taken hold? And some people say that they go further to say this is why you have an Islamic or Islamism rising in that part of the world, because they have tried socialism, capitalism, they have tried authoritarian systems, they have tried everything. So maybe Islam will be the answer.
Yes, actually, there's a very intimate and, I think, tight connection that one can make between the rise of political Islam as the main sort of ideological opposition movement in the Middle East today, which has, of course, many branches, extremist versions and more moderate ones. The rise of political Islam as a response to failed secular authoritarian policies, often backed by the West. I think the case of Iran is a perfect prototype or example of how this story plays out, where you have a pro-Western authoritarian regime that is established in power in Iran, in this case in 1953. It's strongly backed by the West, armed by the West, supported by the West. The West justifies its support for authoritarianism in the name of modernization and stability. But as a result of these deeply authoritarian policies, all opposition to the authoritarian secular state is crushed. There are no political parties. There's no free press. There's no ability to breathe and express a dissenting point of view. And as a result, opposition then shifts to the more traditional sectors of society, the mosque, the bazaar, the religious institutions. And you have, as a response to authoritarian secularism, the rise of a political Islamist opposition. Now, that's a broad, I think, formula that applies not just to Iran, but to many countries across the Arab world. I could apply that to, Syria, to Iraq, to Egypt, to, Algeria and beyond. It's a very common, I think, formula that helps us explain why the Middle East, I think, is so destabilized today. Mm-hmm. I think the fundamental source of instability in the Middle East are precisely and exactly these authoritarian, repressive regimes that are effectively, political tyrannies, despotic regimes, that the West justifies their support by sort of invoking these very facile and unsubstantiated arguments that, look, we can't have democracy because it's too unstable, it's too chaotic. The best way of preserving stability is to, you know, support authoritarianism. You know, there's many examples that I could cite. The most recent one and the most, I think, catastrophic one is what happened in Egypt after the Arab Spring when the coup d'etat takes place in the summer of 2013. The United States and the West effectively back General el-Sisi, who's now presiding over a humanitarian catastrophe. And you're seeing sort of the seeds of instability, violence, once again percolating. So I think the West, in many ways, has a very short-sighted view. They've learned nothing from the Iranian Revolution and how that revolution came about in 1979. As I just said, it came about as a direct result of supporting authoritarian political tyranny in Iran, and they're doing it again. And so there seems to be very little learning here from Western powers. There's a lot of sort of complaining and sort of broad generalizations about why Arabs and Muslims can't democratize, but I think if the West examines its own policies toward the region, both in the past and in the present, there's very little evidence that one can point to where the West seriously was supportive of democratizing movements and civil society movements that were fighting for, you know, genuine political change. So I think that broadly, you know, explains why the region is so unstable and why we're heading to greater stability, because what we're seeing right now is, you know, a doubling down of support for political authoritarianism in the region in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. Perhaps one of the worst cases is, you know, what we're seeing right now with respect to strong Western support for the House of Saud and this very destructive, psychopathic crown prince that is in power and recently, you know, is reasserting his status on the world stage. After this horrific war in Yemen and the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Let me just remind our listeners that we're talking to Professor Nader Hashimi. He is the director of the Center for the Middle East Studies at Denver University. And one of the reasons we have Professor Nader is by request by people for the past 3 weeks are asking me to do a show on Iran. So if you are listening to WMNF 88.5 FM, you can send us your questions to dj@wmnf.org. dj@wmnf.org, and those on Twitter, we're transmitting live, Professor, on Twitter, and they can send also to dj@wmnf.org. One of the things that happened, and I was young at the time, in 1979 when the Islamic Revolution happened, it really shook not only America but the Arab world, and we probably know why. But one of the things when I came to the U.S. and did my master's and had an Iranian professor and read his book on the Islamic Revolution, I found out that it wasn't only the Islamists that were part of it. I think there were the Tuda Communist Party, so many parties. Then the invasion of Saddam Hussein of Iran, which really in the Arab world, it was told to us, it was vice versa. Iran invaded Iraq, galvanized the Islamist. Is that true? And will it do the same thing now with the hardliners within the Iranian government and society if Trump really attacks? Or
No, your point is very much a correct one. Let me just add a few details. You're absolutely correct. The 1979 revolution was a popular revolution. There were many different ideological currents that were supportive of the revolution. Not just the Islamists who supported Khomeini, but also secular nationalists, a variety of left-wing groups, communist, socialist, Maoists, but also, you know, liberal human rights activists, and also what I would call liberal political Islamic groups. The Khomeini hardline Islamists win out in the post-revolutionary power struggle, in part because they had, you know, they were willing to use more repression. They did have a charismatic leader. They did have a network. But also, as you point out, the Iran-Iraq war helps galvanize and consolidate power around Khomeini as a result of that war, which was launched by Saddam Hussein and supported by the various Arab regimes and, you know, indirectly by the West. That war does help the consolidation of hardline Islamist control in Iran. Because there was a sense of, you know, the country had been invaded, everyone had to rally around the flag to protect the country from foreign invasion, and that allowed for greater internal repression in the name of national solidarity. So you do see something playing itself out right now. You know, Donald Trump claims, or Mike Pompeo is actually much more articulate than Trump is on this point. He claims that he wants to support the Iranian people. But what we're seeing right now is a direct result of Trump's policies, as the Iranian people are the biggest victims of this current crisis, and the biggest beneficiaries of Trump's policy are exactly those hardline forces within Iran that strongly oppose political change and democratization. The Islamic Republican Guard Corps, the various senior elites of conservative and hardline factions, they're the ones who are using this opportunity to sort of push back against any calls for political change, to criticize reformist and democratic groups within Iran who want to bring about political change. And so you're seeing a series of developments take place where precisely the opposite of what Mike Pompeo is claiming is happening in Iran, in ways that, as you know, interestingly point out, do have a parallel to 1979.
What was shocking, I think, after September 11 is the fact that George Bush, in his famous speech, lumped Iran and called it axis of evil. How did that affect internal politics in Iran? Because I think Iran has had a very interesting relationship with the U.S. in spite of that troubled relationship, but they have tried to talk to America, I think, or influence politics in the region. How was the axis of evil detrimental to this relationship?
Well, what happened at that time was that there was a reformist president in power, a man by the name of Mohammad Khatami, that was elected for the first time in 1997 and then reelected 4 years later. And he was trying to, I think, democratize Iran, although within the architecture of the existing system. But internationally, in terms of his foreign policy, he was trying to reach out to the United States to break down barriers, to try and convince hardline factions within Iran that it was in Iran's interest to try and break out of its isolation. And so there was this policy of dialogue of civilizations that he articulated that was very much part of this attempt to pursue a new foreign policy from Iran that was less revolutionary, less hawkish, and more in favor of peaceful international relations. When George Bush makes that famous speech after 9/11, it was a gift from God to Iranian hardline forces and to Iran's supreme leader, who for ideological reasons opposes any negotiation or dialogue with the West. So that was another example of how the West either deliberately or indirectly were making statements and pursuing policies that were undermining the internal struggle for political change in Iran and supporting hardline status quo forces.
So explain to us in plain English, Professor Nader, why on earth everybody wants to have a war on Iran? And do they think it's going to be like a cakewalk? Because we have seen a sense of extreme nationalism on the side of Iranians when Saddam invaded Iran, and how the West was supplying him with satellite images, with lots of information and weapons. But the Iranian people did not mind really going into minefields and dying. So do they think that the Iranian people will like rise up against the existing government if they are invaded?
Well, let's just be clear. There are some people in the United States and in Washington, D.C., who also have some regional support in the Middle East that believe what you just have articulated, that if you simply squeeze Iran from the outside, sanction it, pressure it, that the regime is so weak and so corrupt that it will simply collapse, and in its aftermath you'll get some sort of pro-Western regime that will have very nice relations with the United States and recognize Israeli colonization in the West Bank, and everything will be wonderful. That's very much the belief of the John Boltons of the world, of neoconservatives, of people in the Republican Party. And it's also the belief of, you know, the broad pro-Israel network that is supportive of John Bolton's policy. But I would also add another element. This is also the belief of the Saudi crown prince, the Emirati crown prince, and other authoritarian regimes that are working very closely with John Bolton, supporting a policy of regime change in Iran by tearing up the Iran nuclear agreement and pressuring Iran. This is very much what they naively believe, and they have, I think, a completely warped understanding of internal Iranian politics, which is primarily a reflection and a byproduct of the immense amount of power that they have, where they live in these isolated worlds, where they listen to people who basically reinforce their worldview. And so there's a deep disconnect between the reality on the ground, the fact that Iranians do have a deep sense of nationalism, that they do have a long history of fighting imperialism that goes back at least 150 years. And while there is a lot of opposition and deep desire for political change in Iran, it's a desire for nonviolent political change that takes place on Iran's own terms, not as a result of external pressure from extreme war hawks like John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and his regional allies in the Middle East, Netanyahu, and the two Arab princes that I mentioned. So that's, I think, the chasm that separates the reality of Iranian society, Iranian political culture, Iran's history, from this very distorted view of Iran that John Bolton and his friends have bought into.
You're actually right about Mike Pompeo, and you say that he is an evangelical and that there is some religious element, which maybe you can elaborate a little bit on, but he does have ties to the military-industrial complex. Could you address that? Is that also a factor?
Yeah, I think that is a factor. I mean, if you look at some of the people who are actually on Mike Pompeo's staff, his chief of staff, a lot of his advisors, these are people who formerly were working in the defense industry, people who were working for big arms manufacturers. And this is, I think, one of the deeper, broader problems of the corruption and the decline of American democracy, where you have many of the lobbyists of these private organizations and corporations who now find themselves in positions of government, effectively writing legislation and pursuing policies that benefit their own private interests, and not really the interests of the average American citizen or of the United States or of the world more broadly. So I think Mike Pompeo is, you know, he operates in many different, I think, constituencies. One of them is he's very close to the world of these defense contractors who pay and support his campaign. He's very close with the hawkish right-wing pro-Israel lobby. He's very close with the lobbies of these Arab political tyrannies who also have their voice in Washington and spend a lot of money in pursuing their own policies. And then, of course, he's also comes out of the evangelical Christian community. You know, recently he was in Israel where he was giving an interview to one of these right-wing stations, and he openly said that he believes that it's within the realm of the possible that God Almighty has sent Donald Trump to the world to protect Israel from Iran.
Now imagine if Khamenei said that, or a Muslim leader in the Arab world said something like that and invoked God in foreign policy, what would happen? But I have several questions, Professor. Someone is asking about the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, especially that they were designated as a terrorist group. Are they a terrorist group? I mean, what is their role in the Islamic Revolution and the current government now in Iran?
Well, they're the most powerful, significant, and influential organ of Iran's security apparatus. They effectively are, you know, a highly sophisticated organization that not only has a huge military role that they play in Iran, but they also play a very important role in surveillance, intelligence, cracking down on dissent. But also they have a huge stake in the Iranian economy. A lot of businesses are controlled by this particular organization. And then, of course, regionally, they've played a very destructive role in terms of supporting the horrific policies of Bashar al-Assad, where they are deeply implicated in the atrocities that have taken place in Syria over the last 7 years, but also supporting, you know, regional Shia militias in Iraq, and in other parts of the Arab world. So this is an organization that, you know, I mean, objectively, if you want to say, or ask the question, have they engaged in policies that we could consider to be labeled terrorist policies? Yes, they are a repressive terrorist organization. They've engaged in terror, both of the Iranian people and regionally. But, of course, they're not the only group that has done this. There's other groups that have done this in the region that are not connected to the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think what Trump is doing here by designating them as an official terrorist organization, I think this is very much a policy that's coming out of the deep lobbying efforts of right-wing pro-Israel organizations that want to make sure that the Iran nuclear deal is killed and that there's no dialogue between Iran and the United States. Because if you designate an organization as a terrorist group, then you can no longer have any contact or connection, and any Iranian official who has ever had any sort of connection with this organization can then be designated someone who is persona non grata, who cannot be touched or who cannot be invited to any sort of public meeting. So I think there's two things happening here. One, there's the objective reality of what the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has done, mm-hmm. and then the political interests behind this new legislation to designate them as a terrorist organization, which is coming from a different, I think, set of nefarious characters in Washington, D.C., that are really interested in pursuing a war option with Iran.
Let me just remind our listeners, they are listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. This is True Talk, and I'm talking to Professor Nader Hashimi. He is director of the Center for the Middle East Studies at Denver University. I want to ask you, Professor, about Iran vis-a-vis the Arab world and Syria in particular, and Hezbollah. When you talk to the Arabs in the Arab world, they say that they fear Iran. They don't like Iran, bluntly, because of their support of Bashar al-Assad and, of course, their support of Hezbollah. And the second is that they feel that Iran is attempting to Shiite, I don't know even how to say it, the Shia, the Arab world that is mainly Sunni. There are a lot of Shia in the Arab world, but not as much as in Iran. So how do you address these two concerns of the regional Arab lay people that I talk to?
Well, I think it's a very important question that you're asking. I would argue that this negative attitude toward Iran within the Arab world at the grassroots level is a relatively recent development. In 2006, so roughly about 13 years ago, there was a very influential and accurate opinion poll that took place in the Sunni Arab world, in the heart of the Sunni Arab world, that asked the question, who are the two most popular political leaders that you admire? And the number one political leader in 2006 was Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, and number two was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, two Shia political leaders, one of them not even Arab, that ranked at the top of this opinion poll. So that was only 13 years ago, not very long. What's happened since then is, I think, a series of developments that have resulted in Iran's prestige and and how it's viewed in the Arab world to sink precipitously. I think the very catastrophic intervention that Iran got itself involved with in 2011 in Syria, by crushing the Arab Spring protests, they're supporting this horrific regime in Damascus. But also, so I think that's a big part of it. Now, that intervention was backed by Hezbollah, was backed by a lot of Shia militias that Iran has recruited throughout the region to support the dictatorship in Damascus and to pursue these horrific policies in Syria. That has, I think, deeply affected how Iran is viewed in the region, but also in the case of neighboring, Iraq, Iran's support. Mm-hmm. Iran has not played a supportive role for a genuine sort of representative, open and free and democratic Iraq. It's been backing Shia political parties and militias that have sectarianized Iraqi politics in ways that have deeply destabilized that country. And of course, Lebanon is a longer story, where Iran has mm-hmm. always supported Hezbollah and has supported, I think, one side in the political equation in Lebanon. So all of these things have come to a head, I think, in the last few years, really since 2011, where Iran's, once Iran had a reputation as a country that at least was standing up to American and Israeli policies in the region. Now it's viewed, rightfully so, I would argue, as a country that is effectively pursuing a sectarian agenda that is really benefiting its own national policies, or really the national policies of the ruling elite in Iran, which I distinguish from the average citizen in Iran. So that's the perception. I think the claim that you mentioned, that Iran is trying to convert the Arab world to Shiism. That's a gross propaganda line that doesn't have a lot of factual merit, and it is I think perpetuated by largely Saudi Arabia and a lot of Wahhabi clerics that tried to use that theological difference between Sunnis and Shias as a way of as a way of generating hostility toward Iran. I think Iran's should be rightfully criticized on the earlier point that I made. It's regional policy, particularly in Syria, where it is deeply implicated in a lot of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and but also its policies in Iraq and in Lebanon. Yemen often comes up in this equation too, but I think Iran's role in Yemen is also grossly exaggerated.
Let me talk about the nuclear deal. What is wrong with it? What is it that Trump does not like about it? And he says we're ready to negotiate, we're ready to deal. He gives many mixed messages. Right. But what is wrong, objectively, as much as you can, Professor, deal?
First point is that this nuclear deal was supported by the near totality of countries in the international system. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only place where it was controversial was in the United States, primarily among the Republican Party. Throughout Europe, throughout the world, throughout the non-aligned movement countries, you know, this nuclear agreement was celebrated as a major leap forward for international peace and security. And it, in fact, was a UN Security Council resolution was passed that ratified this particular nuclear agreement. So when Trump talks about it, there's a lot of evidence now that has basically clearly suggest that the reason why Trump doesn't like the nuclear deal is because it has Barack Obama's name on it, that if Trump were to sign another deal with Iran, it would look very similar to the current deal. And what's really motivating Donald Trump and his policies toward Iran with respect to the nuclear agreement is his own ego. And we know this because in the recent spat with the British ambassador to the United States, one of the things that came out in these leaked cables was the British ambassador's assessment that Donald Trump's animosity toward the nuclear deal is simply the fact that, you know, this is a legacy of the foreign policy of Barack Obama, and Trump campaigned on rejecting everything that Obama stood for. But objectively, if you actually look at the details of the nuclear agreement, it does roll back Iran's nuclear program significantly, puts it under international inspection, and makes sure that they can't have a nuclear weapon for the foreseeable future. So I think that's really what's driving Trump himself. Around Trump, however, you have the pro-Israel
Bolton and Pompeo,
the Boltons, who have a different agenda. Their agenda is not another nuclear agreement. Their agenda is regime change in Tehran.
It's amazing, Professor. They never learn from the very recent history. But it almost doesn't make sense. Like, if I want to explain this from a background of political science and international relations, I mean, to just say that he is jealous of a former president, I think defies any logic. But I would like to tell our listeners that you are really very critical of the system in Iran, and especially the lack of democratization, that you mentioned, I think, in one of your interviews, that you are being harassed even here in America. Could you address that and the fact that the Muslim ban, for instance, didn't give a chance to young Iranians to come and continue their education in the U.S. And what all these sanctions are doing to the young people of Iran?
You're correct. On the second point, you know, Pompeo keeps saying he wants to support the Iranian people, but at the same time, he's included Iran as one of these countries that are part of the Muslim ban. So there's a clear contradiction here between his professed support for Iran and the Iranian people while effectively banning them from coming to this country. In terms of my own position on Iran, yes, I mean, I'm very critical of the regime. I'm strongly supportive of, you know, the human rights movement in Iran and the pro-democracy struggle in Iran, as I am supportive of those struggles across the Arab world and the broader developing world. So my position and my criticism of the Islamic Republic of Iran has gotten me on sort of a blacklist, where whenever I give interviews And I sort of speak out critically. Sometimes I'm harassed by people who I think are agents of the Islamic Republic. You know, in 2009, just before the Arab Spring protests, there was a major sort of uprising in Iran known as the Green Movement protests. I edited a book on that topic, and that got me on the, I think, on the radar of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard intelligence services, where they, in fact, set up a website attacking my professional reputation and trying to prevent me from giving talks and harassing my friends and my colleagues. That's not something that is, I think, unique to me. Mm-hmm. If you look at other people involved in the struggle for human rights and democracy in Iran, in the Middle East, in the Arab world, they also face harassment. I mean, a lot of this has been exposed recently over the last year. In the context of Saudi Arabia, what Saudi dissidents have been exposed to as a result of the policies of this, you know, horrific crown prince who has gone after Saudi dissidents in many different ways, trying to silence and curtail them. This is very much the way, unfortunately, that authoritarian political tyrannies behave. And it's not just unique to Iran or the Arab world. I mean, you know, there's a long history of repressive authoritarian regimes in the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, Latin America, who've gone after their dissidents abroad by trying to harass them and silence them.
And finally, the economic sanctions, Professor, especially their effect on the lay people and the young people of Iran.
Of course, no. I mean, the sanctions are not hurting the regime, not hurting the Revolutionary Guard Corps, not hurting the Supreme Leader. It's the average citizen that is paying the price in terms of the cost of living, in terms of being able to just, you know, put food on your table. For the first time, I'm hearing stories of malnutrition in some of the smaller towns and villages. Students that I know, you know, they can't pay their tuition fee because the price of the Iranian currency has effectively collapsed. So the primary victims here of Trump's policy toward Iran are not the Revolutionary Guard Corps, but it's the average Iranian citizen who is paying a huge price for policies of which they have no control over.
I want to thank you, Professor Nader Hashimi, Director of the Center for the Middle East Studies at Denver University. Thank you so much, Professor. Maybe next time we can be talking about your books.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Listen to this music by Mohsen Namjou. He plays in the Netherlands, and he is playing with Blazers Ensemble. When we come back, I'm going to be opening the phone lines, 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. What do you think of Trump's back and forth talk about these four women of color and his fans chanting, send her back, send her back? This is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. I personally think this is amazing music. I'm not sure if you like it too, but again, the name is Mohsen, M-O-H-S-E-N, last name, Namjoo, N-A-M-J-O-O. I think music really can touch the heart. It's amazing. I just love this music. Again, the number here is 813-239-9663. I know Mike has been waiting for a long time. Sorry, Mike, but I did not really want to interrupt the conversation with Professor Hashimi. Very, very interesting professor, and maybe later on we can talk about his books, but I'm sure some of you have heard the president back and forth with the Progressive Squad, the representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley. Ayanna Pressley is born in the U.S., as well as Cortez, as well as Rashida Tlaib. We know that Ilhan Omar is from Somalia and became a refugee. I landed in this country in 1989, December. Just before, I think, New Year's Eve, and I started teaching 9 months later and have not stopped teaching. If I got a dollar for every time people told me that why you people do not democratize, why you do not accept democracy, and so many people used to tell me, why don't you run for office? Now that somebody did, actually, she is being ridiculed for criticizing policy. There is a huge difference between being critical of foreign policy or local policy, especially if you are representing local people here in the U.S., and being hateful or hating the country. So the fact that people can be told go back home, I think I find it quite disturbing, because all of us, except for Native Americans, came from some country. Let me go to Mike in Tampa. Good morning, talk. Mike, and so sorry to keep you waiting all this time.
That's right. Most excellent music, as is the program, as is your interview, and was your guest. I really hope to ask your guest a question. I hope you'll remember what I'm going to tell you so you can ask him the next time you have him on.
Okay.
I watched a documentary recently called Zero Days by Alex Gibney. It's also called World War 3.0. And it goes into the fact that the UK, Israel, and the United States entered into a black ops thing where they created an autonomous virus that they snuck into the enrichment facilities of Iran with the purpose of destroying their centrifuges. And it worked to some degree when they first did it. And then the Israelis took the virus and they put it on steroids, and they got it back in there. But when the Israelis put it on steroids, it ended up infesting the world because it's autonomous. So it went out into other systems all across the world, including here in the United States. And we thought we were under a cyber attack. Homeland Security dubbed it the Stuxnet virus. And what actually ended up happening was a terrible thing, because the Iranians not only captured the virus, they own it, they've upgraded it, and the Iranians created the largest cyber army in the world. Now, this is important to understand, because if we get into a conflict with Iran, and if you believe what's in this documentary, Iran presently has the ability to shut down our systems all over our country with the use of this virus.
Very interesting, Mike. I think what I will do is, like you said, pose the question to the professor. Actually, I'm going to send him an email later on in the day. Thank you so much, Mike. But again, if anybody wants to get his or her two cents on the latest from President Trump in picking a fight and his followers chanting, send her back or send her home. It's interesting that Ilhan Omar came to Tampa to speak, and I took my mom and my family to attend. It was during Ramadan, I think the fasting month of Ramadan, I can't remember, and we were fundraising, or she was speaker for a fundraising, I think, for refugees or some poor people. I can't can't remember exactly. And what was sad is the fact that a Zionist group came from out of Tampa and protested and held Israel's flag and where like the police came and arrested a guy or two. And then, of course, there was a small counter demo by Americans holding the American flags and saying that she has the right to speak. They tried to talk to the hotel and prevent the hotel from hosting the event because Ilhan Omar is there. Yet, for instance, people mentioned in the past few months, I have been going back and forth to this website. I don't want to mention the name, but it's very racist. I mean, it's scary to see what is being said out there about people of color. It targets blacks. But then I thought, you know, I'm going to hear so much about Muhammad, the Quran, the jihad, the virgins, the four wives and the Muslims. I mean, you have some of it there, but it was overwhelmingly against immigrants, against black people, and extremely anti-Semitic. I'm not saying anti-Semitic the way some Zionists like to call anybody who criticizes the brutal policies of occupation and the state of Israel and call and label people who BDS as anti-Semitic. No, I'm talking about scary stuff about people for being Jewish, regardless if they are in Israel or here, but of course about American Jews. I mean, it is so scary, so it boggles my mind to find Zionists out there disagreeing with Ilhan Omar and favoring, for instance, banning her and sending her back home. Yet the vile and the hate is white supremacist. You know, this the type of language that Trump uses is white supremacist language. And go to these websites and educate yourselves. And I'm talking to my Zionist friends out there and see the vile language being labeled. That's where your energy should be going, but not demonstrating again against Ilhan Omar and trying to criminalize Rashida Tlaib for being Palestinian and criminalize Ilhan and anybody who criticizes Israeli brutal, inhumane policies in the occupied territories. We should all be really against hate, and the anti-Semitism out there is scary. And they use, I mean, I don't want to repeat what they say, but really it scared the heck out of me, and I decided not to go there except every once in a while because I like to keep up with what is going on there. But there is so much that should unite us, even if we differ on political level, because this hate will touch every one of us. I mean, for God's sake, how many people did not come on a boat. Like, I came on Delta. This is how I arrived to the U.S. in 1989. But most of the people out there came on a boat, like Trump himself. His two wives are immigrants. Ilhan Omar, like if you heard Democracy Now!, Ilhan Omar has been an American more than Melania Trump. I have like 2 or 3 minutes to go. 813-239-9663. Let me go to Cynthia. Good morning, Cynthia. You're on True Talk.
Hi. I really appreciate your show for enlightening us to historical perspective on issues. But I just want to say about the women of color, it's very sad that that this is happening to them. They have not done anything wrong, and they are women. They should be treated and like ladies and their role models for young girls. And I just hate it so much that someone in a position of power is demeaning them in this way. And I have to say that the European people who colonized this country stole it from the original inhabitants. So we have no leg to stand on when it comes to doing things wrong.
Thank you, Cynthia. This is exactly what I was saying. You know, what, like, I wish Native Americans would be calling us and calling this show and to tell us, what do you guys think when all these white people who came and did what they did to you, and listening to them telling people who came more recently what to do and to go back home while this really was originally their home. I think, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I'm not going to take any phone calls because I'm going to be hanging up on people. Let me, because people love this Mohsen Namjoo song, let me leave you with it, and we have less than a minute, and then I think NPR will be next. WMNF Tampa, NPR News is next.